Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. President Trump and congressional leaders failed again today to break a deadlock that has kept the government partially shut down for 2 weeks. McConnell faces pressure from Republicans to stop avoiding shutdown fight, and China's economy continues to slow. What's the impact of these stories going forward? Well, it's Friday, so it's panel time. My first guest is a lifelong activist and scholar, former dean of the African American Studies Department at Ohio University, former director of the King Center in Atlanta, Tom Porter. Tom, good evening, and as always, man, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Good evening, Wilmer, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, sir. Thank you very much. My other guest, he's been a TV news reporter for more than 20 years, a senior Washington, D.C. correspondent since 2008. He's been a reporter at large covering two presidencies, Congress and State Departments. He is currently a PhD student in the Department of Communications, Culture, and Media Studies at Howard University, Colin Campbell. As always, Colin, welcome back. Happy New Year to you, man.
Happy New Year, Dr. Leon. Good to be here.
Well, Nancy Pelosi is elected speaker as Democrats take control of the House. Democrats assumed control of the House yesterday and elected Representative Nancy Pelosi of California as House Speaker. They then moved to defy President Trump and passed bills that would open the government agencies shuttered by an impasse over his insistence on funding for a border wall. Tom, we'll start with you. Your thoughts on this newest wave of divided government in the United States?
Well, it was to be, expected. Trump thrives with divisiveness. You know, on the other hand, the Democrats haven't really offered that much. I don't think, to be honest with you, that either party, or the traditional parties, are concerned about the government shutdown. I think they're basically concerned about maintaining their positions and their control over the various franchises. Nancy Pelosi faces some disturbance coming from the left, and she's demonstrated that she is really closer to the Republican Senate than she is to the Democratic Senate.
Colin, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a really unfortunate situation as both sides have hit this impasse. And of course, I think that it comes down to almost egos here. Listen, you've got a president who many would describe as megalomaniacal. I think we could pretty much all agree on that. And I think that right now he's being driven by his constituents that want him to really build this wall. And he is being adamant, especially when it comes to defending the narratives and the rhetoric coming from the far right. Those in that pocket of his political affiliation that say he will be judged on whether or not he delivers on this wall. Now, we have to keep in mind, too, that the president is known for his buildings around the United States. He's wanted to create, put buildings in other countries, which are being investigated now, right? And for him, this is almost like an edifice. This would be an edifice to symbolize who he is as this great builder and a person who negotiates well. So part of this is attached to the president's ego. But on the other side, you have House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who is in this position as a guide for younger leadership. And that's part of the reason why there was some controversy as to whether or not people would vote her back into this position. She's the first person to actually lose a position and then gain it back in decades, right? And I believe the first woman to ever do so. So again, there's a lot riding on her position as well. So you have this impasse where she has to deliver. She doesn't want to be seen as a weak leader, someone who's going to acquiesce to the president, someone who's going to acquiesce to bullying. And so you have this battle of egos as well. Meanwhile, you have hundreds of thousands of Americans who are affected by this. Many of us are already familiar with the 800,000 government workers who are affected by this. I was speaking to a friend of mine earlier this week who said that fortunately for her, she was paid just before the new year. here, and she says she has about another week of cushion, maybe 2 weeks of cushion, before she has to start worrying about how she will pay her mortgage. And she feels like she's one of the fortunate people. Even though she can't say months out from now that she would be safe, there are people who are already behind in their payments, people who already have these financial obligations that they cannot meet because they are not getting paid. And then we see the effects spilling over into our environment, with national parks being, they're not, the regulations on how they're being cleaned up are starting to degrade. People are using the sides of roads or trash cans to relieve themselves if they need to go to the bathroom. There's emergency funding in the state of New York that had to be put into place so that Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty could continue to look in a presentable manner, according to the governor. So there are a lot of things that are already starting to fall apart here, even though it seems that both sides are not any closer to resolving this difference of opinion on how they should go forward with the U.S. budget.
Tom, you said Pelosi being closer to the Republican center than the Democratic left. I find it interesting in the rules package that Speaker Pelosi put forth, there's an austerity provision over the objections of progressives. There's a pay-as-you-go provision requiring that all new spending is to be offset with either budget cuts or tax increases. And Pelosi is now saying that this pay-as-you-go provision is different than the one that was presented, I think, in 2007, because this one has the option of tax increases. But I think we would know that, particularly as we get closer to 2020, Democrats are going to do everything they can not to have to explain tax increases. So we're talking about budget cuts, and we know also that it's social programs that wind up being on the chopping block. So is this Nancy Pelosi being more center-right, as you indicated?
Without a doubt. All of this is taking place, what I might say, against the backdrop of a fundamental realignment of the American body politics. And I think that both Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump, I think they all missed this. And that is, people are more concerned about issues than they are about party. They're more concerned about climate. They're more concerned about structural reform. They're more concerned about racism that's dividing the country. And what Nancy Pelosi is doing is she's concentrating on consolidating the power of the traditional Democrats who just lost the last election, because for the most part, the Democratic Party is governed by elites from the West Coast and the East Coast. And what you get is that when it comes down to the Electoral College, where are the votes? Where is the guts of this society? It's in the Middle West. It's in the middle part of the country. And there's a fundamental realignment, and it's not left or right. It's easy to say that, but it's around issues. And what Nancy Pelosi has not put forth anything new. And you know they're not going to raise taxes close to the election.
So it's also not only Nancy Pelosi, but when you look at the hierarchy, Colin, as you look at the hierarchy on the Democratic side, it's Nancy Pelosi. It's Chuck Schumer. You look at those, it's the same folks that we've been seeing for the last 15 or 20 years.
That's right. What do they say the definition of insanity is, right? Doing the same thing over
and expecting a different result.
And expecting a different result, right. And that's why you heard a lot of kickback when it was theorized that Nancy Pelosi would again become the House Speaker. There were a lot of people who were hoping that there would be a change of leadership here. And she convinced the leaders. And of course, she's very good at politicking, why she should be leader again. And one of those selling points was that she knew how to maneuver through Congress. And this would be a learning point for for some of the younger legislators, such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, someone who was initially in opposition to Pelosi being House leader, but then said that she would later support her as part of this. Because what she learned, AOC learned, is that there are going to be compromises and that she has to pick her battles. And I believe the implementation of this PAYGO austerity measure is one of those battles that AOC doesn't necessarily agree with, but believes that she may have to stand in line because of other battles that she wants to stand out for and that she really believes in.
Tom, this PAYGO issue raises the question to me about, and this is a question that actually you presented a while ago about the so-called progressives that are coming in to Congress. And you raised the question, is it going to be qualitative, as in policy output, substantive policy output, or is it just going to be quantitative, the number of women, the number of minorities, the number of, for example, there's now, I think, a lesbian Indian woman, Native American woman, I think it is. And, you know, now we've got two Muslim American women. Are we looking at numbers or are we looking at substantive policy output, which is what politics is actually supposed to generate? So go ahead, Tom.
I think it's a little bit of both. It's mostly form. What you see in the news right now is that this is the most diverse Congress that we've ever had in this country. They're talking about quantity, more of this, you know, more women, more blacks, more blah, 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 blah. But that does not speak to substance. As we can see already in Alexandra Costa's fights with, not fights, they're trying to pit her as against Nancy Pelosi. The fact of it is there's confusion in the Progressive Caucus, in the left of the Democratic Party. And so she's having to find her way. But in a larger scheme of things, so far what we have is form. What we have in control of the Democratic Party is the old people who've been there. And that includes the black ones like Elijah Cummings and what have you. So there's nothing new. The problem is, and I want to go back to what I said, there's a fundamental realignment and shift going on in American politics. What we saw in the 2016 election was populism on the left and populism on the right. Populism on the right won. But that being said, Donald Trump has a very small base because as we see things like the shutdown of the government, as we see things like no attention to climate control, as we see no structural reform, as we see racism rearing its head in many different ways in this country, that people are beginning to rethink things. And it's not along party lines. It's ideological and it's on issues. And I think that in the short run, Nancy Pelosi and her cronies will be successful. In the long run, I think they're misreading what's happening now. They're misreading history because anti-austerity programs, they didn't work in the Great Recession or the Great Depression.
Before I go to Colin, Tom, let me follow up with you on this question. Even though you're saying that there's a realignment of politics in this country and that the realignment is not based on party, it's based on ideology, earlier political realignments in this country have always been managed by the racial context. Do we still see that playing itself out in this instance?
When you say racial, I'm not sure exactly what you...
For example, with the abolition of slavery, we had newly freed slaves, we had working class whites forming coalitions. They introduced racism into the mix, letting those white workers know that the one thing they didn't want to do was align themselves with black people. We can look at the early strikes in this country and how at the Ford plant and when the Pinkertons were brought in to break up the strikes, who did they bring in to offset the strikers? They brought in blacks using race as the wedge between the working class. So history is replete, in my in my assessment, with race being used as one of the wedges to ensure that even though there may be these ideological divisions, that the debate is still being managed and race is used as one of those elements.
Well, I think why that has worked in the past, and I think that certainly the alt-right and the right, it's playing the race card. But I think these issues, I mean, when you look at the issue of climate change, the fact that we might not be here or our grandchildren might not be here is something that cuts across race, class, race and class. So these issues that are emerging as America continues on a descending line of development, these issues that are emerging among people who want to see a better world, who want to see a healthier world, who want to see quality education for all people, what have you. These are not right or left issues. These are human issues. And I don't think it's going to work this time. The problem is whether the right will win out and we could have some form of fascism.
Is it then becoming more of a class issue?
Well, you can't separate class from race, but in the final analysis, class is really what is important. The relationship to people, to productive forces, and to the major parts of a society. But I never separate class from race, because in a country that was founded fundamentally out of slavery, you could never separate
right.
race from class.
Colin Campbell, your thoughts?
Yeah, I just I think that you have Congresswoman Jackson Lee, who wanted to reintroduce a reparations bill. And although this is obviously a source of controversy among many legislators, she talks about issues of race and class when it comes to trying to deal with the U.S.'s original sin. Now, if we were to tie this into the question you asked before, obviously this is not going to be a top agenda item for either part of a bicameral Congress. But Jackson Lee says it's important to look at these issues and to address them in an educative manner so that they can be addressed, followed up with, and learned from in future governments, in future iterations of the U.S. government. So I think that tying in these issues of class and race are things that the democratically led House wants to look at, but they have to get through these other issues first. And one of them is the budget. I think that they are trying to set themselves up for 2020. If they want to take on Donald Trump again, they have to position themselves as the fiscally responsible party if they want to win. And they can exploit Republicans' very loose restrictions when it comes to deficit spending, when it comes to government budget spending. And I think that's why we have seen Pelosi bring up this PAYGO program, which is taken from the CutGo program that Republicans put in place back in 2011, I believe. So you have this intersection of wanting to appear fiscally responsible, but also addressing the needs of the average American, but looking at it in a cultural context, something that that Republicans usually are not well known for. The leadership from Democrats, or not exactly leadership, but some of the Democrats want to take on these positions to show that they can take leadership on these issues better than other lawmakers can.
Tom, before we go to the break, to Colin's point about the Democrats wanting to show themselves to be the fiscally responsible party as the Republicans with their ridiculous upper-class tax cuts have blown a bigger hole in the deficit. But the interesting thing, the Democrats with their pay-as-you-go provision, they aren't talking about a cut in military spending. They can talk about Medicaid, they can talk about Medicare, they can talk about aid to family with TANF, which used to be aid to families with dependent children. They can talk about a whole lot of stuff, but I don't hear them saying a mumbling word about cutting the military budget. And as you look at the voting records of a lot of these Democrats, they're as hawkish as the Republicans are. So
without a doubt, and putting together a balanced budget doesn't prove anything. The budget has to reflect the will and the needs of the people. And just showing that you can balance the budget, that you can manage society, and you're not cutting the military budget, you're not really for public education for all, which is an old idea, it's not a new idea, by the way. Not putting money in climate change. I mean, they've already begun to sabotage under the guise of attacking the left wing of the party. They've already begun to sabotage cleaning up the environment. I mean, the bottom line of it is that unless the Democrats put together a budget and a budget strategy that reflects the will and the needs of the people, it doesn't mean a thing. And I think they're going to find that out.
Folks in Flint, Michigan are still drinking contaminated water, and kids in Detroit public schools can't use the public drinking fountains in their schools. Why? Because the water is contaminated. But we can sure find enough money to send bullets and bombs and other kinds of foolishness into Yemen and into Syria and into Afghanistan. Hey, folks, Dr. Wermelion here, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. This is Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we have with us the former dean of the African-American Studies Department at Ohio University, former director of the King Center in Atlanta, Tom Porter, and we're also joined by senior Washington, D.C. correspondent since 2008, Colin Campbell. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik, and I'm your host, Dr. Wermelion, and it's Friday, so it's panel time, and we've got with us Tom Porter, the former dean of the African-American Studies Department at Ohio University, former director of the King Center in Atlanta. He's been a lifetime activist and just overall thought leader. And we also have with us Colin Campbell, senior Washington, D.C. correspondent, reporter at large covering presidencies and Congress and state departments. He's now a PhD student in the Department of Communications and Culture at Howard University. Gentlemen, thank you both for staying with me. Interesting side note here. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. ABC News and others reported new Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib not apologizing for cursing out Trump in call for impeachment. That's the headline. Now, first, she didn't cuss him out. She called him an MF, but she didn't cuss him out, in my opinion. Tlaib, who was sworn in as Michigan's representative from the 13th Congressional District yesterday, was speaking at an event for MoveOn.org when she relayed a conversation with her son to the crowd. Quote, "And when your son looks at you and says, 'Mama, look, you won. Bullies don't win.' And I said, 'Baby, they don't, because we're going to go in and impeach the MF,'" end quote. Now, folks are asking her to apologize. Well, and Trump was also asked about this during today's press conference. So he can call women pigs. He can say women are ugly. He can call Mexicans rapists and drug dealers. And he can confess to being a sexual predator and still become president, with folks saying, "Well, he's saying exactly what I want him to say." But here, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib says what I think a lot of people are saying. I've sure heard that reference to Donald Trump in more than 1,000 settings. But now she's being asked to apologize. It sounds to me as though there's somewhat of a double standard here. Colin Campbell.
Yeah, although I wouldn't agree with the language that she used.
I'll give you that.
Yeah, I do feel that there is a double standard here.
But Colin, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Colin. Haven't you heard people refer to him in that manner?
I was going to say, I don't know if I've heard those specific words, but I will say, and this speaks to your point, that around town, D.C., for example, I have seen a lot of graffiti.
Yes.
With F. Trump.
Yes.
I've actually started collecting photos.
Oh, you know, I've been doing the same thing. I've been doing the very same thing, going around with my camera and taking photographs of that graffiti.
Okay, all right. So I feel less crazy now because I haven't told anyone that. Only one other person knew that. But I just thought it was very interesting that I've never seen that reference to any president. Even though a lot of people disparaged and derided Obama, I never saw that language used specifically for a president of the United States. And there was also a hip hop song with that same refrain. So I just thought, you know, this is kind of interesting, not in a very good way, I would say, but not necessarily bad in the way that people are able to express themselves freely. And I think that's exactly what this lawmaker did. It's good that she's able to do it. Should she apologize for it? I don't know if that's really the case. We have heard the president definitely use some very suspect language, some very condemning language, and many people would definitely attribute lots of the vitriol that we've seen in this country to the president. We've seen people assaulted at his rallies. We've seen him call other people's names. We've seen him call NFL players who are protesting the deaths of black men sons of bees.
There you go.
So I don't think that she necessarily owes him an apology, but at the same time, I don't know if calling names really resolves any issues either. In an age of where a lot of people are loath to submit themselves to respectability politics, I do feel that there should be a level of civility, even though our president may not always exhibit those notable traits.
And Colin, let me say, obviously, since you haven't heard that specific reference, you are obviously traveling in much higher circles than I am. And that doesn't surprise me. I mean, knowing you as I do, that doesn't surprise me. Tom Porter, your thoughts.
Well, first of all, I don't think she said anything that she needs to apologize for. Lindsey Graham curses all the time, and he's always backs it up and says, excuse my French. He just did it on Meet the Press.
Yes, he did.
On Sunday. I mean, it's not only a double standard, but it's BS. I mean, the fact of it is the word MF can be used in a lot of different ways. If Miles Davis said that Coltrane is a bad MF, that means he can really play his saxophone. But when
Touché.
They say this MF needs to be impeached, that's saying that we need to get rid of this person. It's language. And it's a sideshow. We shouldn't even be discussing it. It is a sideshow. She said it. I hear it every day. If you go in the barbershop, or if you talk to anybody, when Donald Trump's name come up, it's never very nice what people say. And you know, quite frankly, I'm not one of these guys that believes if you can't respect the man, respect the office of the president. There's a man in the office. There's no such thing as an office, and Trump has proved that. There's no such thing as an office that doesn't have a person in it, and he's gone about breaking every rule in the book. I just want to go back to this old issue of reparations just for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's some issues that won't be resolved within the context of the United States. Reparation is one that's going to be solved internationally. The UN has already said that the United States owes us reparations. If you think that the same people that brought us slavery are going to bring us freedom, I ain't buying that. So some of these issues that we're talking about, they're going to be settled in international forums. I mean, the United States just backed out of some other UN organization that deals with civil rights and human rights today. So the more they separate themselves from the international rule of law, the more these issues will be solved internationally and not by the United States government. They are forfeiting their rights to solve these problems.
You know, Colin, to Tom's point on that issue, imagine the power if the Congressional Black Caucus as a body either initiated a statement to the UN internationalizing the issue of reparations instead of continuing to submit congressman from Detroit, from Michigan.
Conyers.
Instead of John Conyers' legislation, if they took this before the UN, similar to We Charge Genocide, imagine the power and what that would do if the Black Caucus did something like that.
Yeah, it would be very powerful. I think that's why it's been given such renewed interest and why a lot of people are lauding Jackson Lee's efforts to keep this as part of the conversation within the zeitgeist. A lot of people believe that when Conyers resigned from Congress under the controversy that he did, that this would die out and that people would lose interest. Of course, it would be a very tough uphill climb to appeal to lawmakers in this country, since they have been throughout the decades or centuries rather committed to supporting the hierarchy, the white paternal hierarchy as it is. But at the same time, I think Jackson Lee is keeping this as part of the conversation, keeping the interest there so that when the time is right, or possibly when time isn't even right, but when there's that opportunity, that right time to present this to the United Nations, it's not coming out of nowhere, that people will continue this conversation, especially if Democrats are looking to really change the landscape in 2020. Will reparations be forgotten about? And I think that Jackson Lee and many others are saying this needs to be part of the conversation as we look forward to the next election so that we can actually address this issue, that it's just not a talking point or just an idle conversation, that there actually is substantive action on something that the U.S. should have taken care of hundreds of years ago. And of course, this year is 400 years since abducted Africans arrived on U.S.'s shores. So this is definitely salient today, especially amongst those within the Black community in the U.S.
But Tom, if Sheila Jackson Lee and the others in the caucus were to present this resolution, that's the word I was looking for, but before the U.N., see, I can't see Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer green lighting something like this. I see that the CBC would have to go outside of the established Democratic Party leadership, and I don't see those folks having the guts making a move like that.
I don't see that happening. I actually think, as a matter of fact, the issue of reparations is already an international issue. Henry Beckel has written a book, Britain's Black Debt, and already the countries of the Caribbean who were British colonies are already on that case. So slavery was an international phenomenon, and the United States was not just the only place where slavery existed. And it won't be solved in the context of the United States. It'll have to be an international solution to the problem. One is they're not going to pay. Whenever you start talking about reparations, I heard Hillary Clinton, and she said her enlightened Negro friends said that what was needed was more programs and more this. That's not what they gave to Israel. You know, I mean, come on, guys, you know. And so to expect that the Black Caucus will do anything, they're in lockstep behind Nancy Pelosi. I mean, they couldn't even stand up to get Barbara Lee, you know,
right,
a position. They couldn't support Donna Edwards. They didn't support Ben Jealous, who ran for governor. I mean, so to expect that these guys, men and women in the Black Caucus, with the exception of a couple, are going to do anything except run behind the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's, because they want in. That's the bottom line.
That's the voice of Tom Porter. This is Friday. That means it's the roundtable. We're also joined with the roundtable by Colin Campbell. And this is the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Today is Friday, which means it is panel time, and we have been getting what I believe is some incredible insight and analysis from my two panelists, Colin Campbell, as well as Tom Porter. Gentlemen, I want to switch gears from the domestic to the international front and talk about the slowdown of the Chinese economy. Weakening domestic demand and the ongoing trade war with the U.S. has dealt a double whammy to the Chinese economy. And, you know, a lot of folks, again, today at Donald Trump's press conference, they were talking about Apple and the impact that Apple's stock and the declining sales and the impact that that's having on the Chinese economy. But there were some couple other data points that to me were very interesting. First, Starbucks. China is a centerpiece of Starbucks' expansion plans. And last May, Starbucks said it planned to ramp up store openings to 600 annually with a view of having 6,000 stores in China. But last month, the company said same store sales growth in China would be as low as 1% in the long term. And that's below the 3 to 4% growth that's seen for the U.S. and the rest of the world. FedEx was forced to cut its profit forecast in December, just months after having it go up. The shipping giant blamed global trade issues, which have been fueled by the U.S.-China trade spat. And the final one, and this one I found very, very interesting, Tiffany stock. Tiffany, which is the toast of Wall Street due to improving performance during 2018, was partially driven by demand from Chinese tourists. However, it's been hit by the weaker Chinese economy, with the jewelry giant reporting lackluster sales in November. And they say that this was based on a clear pattern of Chinese shoppers cutting back. Fewer Chinese tourists coming to New York and shopping at Tiffany's. So not only is Apple a clear indicator of what's going on with this economy, but again, Starbucks, FedEx, Tiffany's, those are just three examples. And again, Tiffany to me was a really big, big surprise. Tom, your thoughts on what's going on with the Chinese economy and the impact that the Chinese economy is having, not only on the United States, but globally.
Well, I mean, I think you have to look at one of the things that we do when I talk to people about China, they try and look at China through Western eyes and not deal with the fact that whether you like it or not, China has a different system. And therefore, so what do I think about that? Well, the trade war, which is a war on China by Trump, is really not a trade war. It's a war on China. But it's having a negative impact, because the Chinese can do without Starbucks, but the West can do without Chinese products. At the same time that China is shifting its emphasis in terms of its economy to creating a consumer base in China. Coupled with that, the Chinese people are known to be big savers. So There is a slowing of the economy at the same time that China is saying that it's going to have its entire population out of poverty by the year 2025, I think. Now, that's because China puts emphasis on its human capital. The United States does not. So you have two different systems going in two different directions. So whereas the Chinese economy might be slowing, the United States, quite frankly, they say that the United States economy is booming. Well, I was in Whole Foods the other day, and the woman I know who worked there said their business was bad. And it was bad because of the government slowdown. But if the economy is booming, people got money. They got some money in the hole. They got some disposable income. They do not. People are living from paycheck to payday, from paycheck to paycheck in a booming economy. So I think you have to look at what's really happening in China as opposed to, yes, the economy is slowing, but it's also slowing in the context of a transition from to a more consumer-based society. And China puts a lot of money in the human capital and uplifting people from poverty. So that's bound to happen when you get something like this trade war, which Trump has started, which is having you just listed the impact that the trade war has on the United States companies.
Don't you also, Tom, have to look at China's Belt and Road Initiative, Made in China 2025 initiative? China is expanding in the global space, where the real driver in the U.S. economy is stock and stock buyback based upon the tax cuts, the corporate tax cuts that the Trump administration gave last year, which is, to me, really an artificial indicator of financial growth and financial strength.
We used to call that the fictitious accumulation of capital. The stock market went up today in the midst of a government shutdown. There's no relationship between the stock market and the real economy. So, and to your question about the Belt and Road Initiative, the world should be grateful that there is a country like China today. And I'm not saying that China's perfect, but the fact that things that China espouses, whether you're talking about healthcare, the environment, the emphasis on human capital, and all of that, China is the only country that's doing that today and has the power and the economic base to do this. So the Belt and Road Initiative is really a blessing that you have a country that's willing really unite the world. Very positive global sense.
Colin Campbell, your thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say that it's important to remember that China actually is the largest foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities after U.S. citizens. So when China is suffering from shrinking in spending, the U.S. also has to be concerned about that because it relies on China to sell its own exports as well. So even though the West relies a lot on China's goods to purchase, it also relies on it by selling its exports. And I think this is a big growing concern as this trade war continues. I mean, a lot of people were outraged with the first $50 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods, and then that additional $100 billion. That the president imposed. So I think this is an area of concern. This is definitely already affecting the global economy, but the U.S. has to be cognizant of how much it does need China, perhaps even more than China needs the United States, as it relies on less of its exports and really draws from its shrinking in domestic spending, how that's going to affect the U.S. when it is trying to grow its economy despite this very serious trade war that's going on.
So, Tom, when we look at John Bolton and we look at Mike Pompeo, and I can't remember the name of the other guy that's in the Trump administration, that's the real anti-China guy. He's the number one, he's the primary negotiator, the trade negotiator with China. His last name begins with an S. I'm drawing a blank on his last name. Anyway, when we look at these guys and the ideology that they bring to the table, almost a Cold War, I use that term very loosely. I'm not talking about U.S.-Russia relations. I'm just saying Cold War in terms of stagnant type of relationship. Whereas China, when they were rolling out or trying to roll out their 5G technology, they're telling the United States, we would like to work with you. We would like to work in concert as we try to develop the next wave of technology. The United States says, no, we're going to do this alone. Now we've got China landing on the far side of the moon and understanding the technology that it took to make that happen. It really seems as though the ideology and the foreign policy drivers of the United States are really outdated, outmoded, and going to drive the U.S. economy, if not the country, further in the ditch.
And they're not very bright. Not very bright.
And they're not very bright.
The fundamental issue, and it's an issue for the United States, is not an issue for China. China will survive without the United States. The United States cannot survive without China. And the United States cannot survive isolating itself from the rest of the world. That being said, I think we're beginning to see something in the United States that you're hearing more and more, and that is the possibility that Donald Trump will resign. That you hear that more and more. Chris Matthews is saying it, Joe Scarborough, more and more that there's this conversation, there's a narrative that says he's going to resign or he should resign. And I think what that means is that it's no longer what the Congress or the Senate does. It's in the hands of the captains of industries, the people that run the society. We forget that congressmen and senators, they are paid to run. They have to raise money from people. So it's the people they raise money from, the corporations and the big boys, they want to do business all over the world. They're not concerned. It's a mistake for people to believe that the people who run this country are actually concerned about the people of this country. They're concerned about making money. If you think they're concerned about the people of the country, drive through West Virginia, Kentucky, or Tennessee, or Pennsylvania. But get outside of the big city and think, you know, we think it's black folks. Think if they really care about the people. But what they do care about is being able.
Hang on, Tom. Don't gloss over that. That right there is a key point, because when you're talking about outside of Pittsburgh, when you're talking about West Virginia, when you're talking about Mitch McConnell and his crew in Kentucky coal country, you're talking about poor white people who have been poor and white for a very long time.
And are getting poorer as the mines shut down and what have you. So having said that, I think that the people who really run the country, the people in charge, I think they've had enough. Because in the final analysis, what they don't want to make America great again. They want to be able to stay in the game. And in order to stay in the game, you've got to have global relationships. You got to be able to have markets that you can sell your products to. And what Bolton and these guys represent is a withdrawal and isolationist policy. It won't work. It never has.
Colin Campbell, your thoughts?
Yeah, I just think that we have to keep in mind that the president is not known for really being the biggest truth teller. So even when it comes to this trade policy that he has with China, he's definitely overblown the trade deficit that the U.S. shares with China. I think he's argued that it's about $500 billion when actual figures coming out of the Commerce Department say it's closer to $375 billion. Now, it's still a big figure, right? But it does go to speak to the president's grasp of what is actually occurring in the global economy, the U.S. economy, but also telling the truth. And I think that more and more Americans are realizing that the president's rhetoric is really not in their best interest, as it's more self-serving more than anything. Yes, we live in a country that is increasingly reliant upon its state of neoliberalism. But I think that the president is a symptom of this type of mentality that's been growing over the years. And that's why we've seen a widening in the wealth gap. That's why we find it very difficult to provide health care for all Americans. And that's such a controversial thing, even though most other developed countries at our level already have a situation like this already in place. There has been this movement to really just focus on making money for businesses rather than the people. And the lawmakers seem to sharpen their rhetoric in those interests. Even though they try to make it seem like they're for the people, their actions show otherwise.
We come to the point of our weekly roundup where I ask my guests what they're looking at for next week. But let me tell you what I'm seeing. The president's press conference today, he was very dismissive of the federal workers that are now working without remuneration, without getting paid. Mitch McConnell has been conspicuously silent up until now. Mitch McConnell, I think, has been trying to just leave this between the Democrats and the president. But we're now hearing from Republican senators like Cory Gardner of Colorado. He's saying it's time to end the shutdown. Susan Collins of Maine, Republican senator, is saying that she'll support separating Homeland Security funding from the other appropriations bills. We've got two senators that are now coming out publicly and saying it's time to move this thing along. And the president said today during his press conference, oh, we're going to be working diligently over the weekend. He's still at least giving the impression that, oh, I'm not worried. No, nothing to see here. We're going to get this done. I think over the next couple of days, we're going to see a shift here, especially if Cory Gardner and Susan Collins are joined by two or three or four other Republican senators. And that's going to put the pressure on Mitch McConnell to go to Donald Trump and say, enough of this foolishness, man. We got some work to do here. Let's get this government open and let's deal with this wall later. We've got about 3 minutes left. Let me come to you, Tom Porter. What are you looking at for next week?
Well, I expect them to try and bring the shutdown to a close sooner rather than later. I expect that Trump will switch his position about getting out of Iraq because we're in the Middle East. Because the Arabs hold the trade deficit might be with China, but the Arabs hold most of the United States debt. We're more in debt to the Arabs than we are, and so that's that. Looking at the Middle East, I'm looking to see some shifts in a lot of different ways. The split will widen between the progressives in the Democratic Party and the Nancy Pelosi wing.
Colin Campbell, your thought. What are you looking at for next week?
Yeah, I'm just going to look and see how the lawmakers react when members of Trump's administration could get a pay raise of about $10,000 as we are in the midst of a government shutdown. I also want to see what happens with trade as it corresponds to the steel industry. The president has shifted away from saying that he wants a concrete wall to a steel wall and promoting the improvements in the steel economy in the United States. And I'll be looking forward to seeing whether or not that is reflected on the stock market with an increase in trade.
Colin, sorry to jump in here real quick, but did you know that steel is stronger than concrete? Did you know that? Did you know the steel is stuck?
You know, the president keeps wowing us with these factoids. Be revelations for him, but no one else, right? Man of steel himself.
So I'm sorry. I just couldn't let that pass. Go ahead and finish your thought if I didn't interrupt.
That's what I'll be looking. No, that's okay. That's what I'll be looking at to see. If the drumbeat grows louder for the president to really come forward with a real and earnest in trying to end this partial government shutdown, especially when you have Republicans who are starting to increase in number, pressuring the president to ameliorate this government shutdown now and to see what happens with steel. I'll be very interested in seeing what happens with that for next week.
Tom Porter and Colin Campbell, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it. And again, folks, I think this is key. You've got two Republican senators that have already come out between yesterday and today saying enough of this, it's time to move the game along. And we'll see tomorrow, but probably Monday. If you get another one Monday, if you get another Republican Monday, you can expect another Republican Tuesday. And it's going to start to be the drip, drip, drip. And that could really be a game changer here on getting the government employees back to working for the government. Folks, you have been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik, because thank God the government can't shut this one down. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.